riff.com.
Right on, you rock.
Here at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your riff rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. As usual, a great pleasure to be here with you, and welcome to everybody listening into our listening in our immediate Detroit area, also Southern Ontario, Northern Ohio, directly on WRIF 101.1, but also to all of you listening on radiopower.org, WRIF.com, or wherever you're picking this show up, all around the country, and, of course, all around the world. Hello to friends in Seoul, South Korea, Shanghai, Sydney, Australia, and we can't forget Jacob and Oulu, Finland. Right. That's up in the Arctic Circle. Must be about 6 or 7 in the morning. He's getting up for, well, I don't think he works anymore. But hi, Jacob. Thanks for all your support over there in Finland, making this show a hit in Oulu, Finland. All right. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. You're just tuning in for the first time. It's a talk show. I do a little talking. You do a little talking. And that way, we figure out what each of us is thinking. You know, I thought that the Deadeye Dick story, you know, the Cheney hunting accident thing, was probably all over. I mean, you know, it's sort of like flogging a dead lawyer or something. Well, it was a dead horse. I guess that's the phrase. Flogging a dead horse, and why keep on it? I mean, some of the Republicans are saying, you know, it's just a hunting accident. Why are they on it? Well, Time and Newsweek are going with it big time this week. They're not letting it go because two things. There's a lot of unanswered questions still. And secondly, it's indicative of how this whole joint operates. Secrecy, arrogance, denial, all of it. And one begins to see what? A pattern of lies. So did it really come down the way we were told? Well, we can check out Time and Newsweek. One thing that Time is doing is headlining a poll. Dick Cheney approval rating 29%. That's amazing. You know, I always talk about the fascist third. The right wingers that are so far right wing that, you know, there's nothing that these guys could do, get caught doing, any act of violation of the Constitution, whatever. And they always have that fascist third, and that's 33 and a third. Well, even about 4% of them have peeled off. I think some of you have heard this song, but I think it's probably worth giving a listen. It sounds a lot like a band we're pretty familiar with. Let's give a listen on Night Call on WRIF.
Dick Cheney's got a gun. Dick Cheney's got a gun.
He's got a gun on Night Call, WRIF 101 FM. Hey, give me a call, 313-298-WRIF. We're doing a talk show. You think this is being overdone? I sure don't. Grind it to this SOB. I mean, think about what this guy has done to this country. And does he deserve a little bit of it back? Hey, sure. And he was on Fox News. That's kind of old news. And he said, it's a moment I'll never forget it. It was one of the worst days of my life. Yeah. I'm sure, because normally these guys do not get called to task for what they do. They're always able to slide out of it. Even when Cheney was head of Halliburton and he acquired Drexel Industries, even though he was told, hey, look, there's all these asbestos suits pending against it, and it turned out to be a financial disaster, he still walked away with millions, still gets about $150,000 a year from Halliburton. And he was on Fox News, so people say, well, what do you think? It's a right-wing news outlet, and naturally he's going to get a sympathetic hearing. It's more than that. That's not the only reason that he goes over there, or that the Vice President of the United States goes on a far right-wing talk show like Rush Limbaugh. He goes on there to legitimate them. He goes on there to privilege them. In other words, that he, since one would think that an elected officer of the United States of America represents everyone, which of course is ridiculous, they only represent the rich, the powerful, the privileged, and the far right wing, that that he would go on a mainstream station, that he would subject himself to some decent questioning. Now, it of course gets a sympathetic hearing on Fox, but also it moves the whole spectrum to the right. Is that this propaganda arm? What, remember what we've always called it here on Night Call, Foxhole News, this shill for the White House that unquestionably repeats everything that comes out of the White House. So that's one of the functions of it all. I mean, it'd be like if Al Gore had rightly taken office, had he not been cheated out of the presidency, or if John Kerry had have rightfully taken office, had he not been cheated out of the presidency in 2004 by the shenanigans in Ohio. Well, you don't believe that? Hey, go to my website. Oh, speaking of my website, if you want that song, if you want to download that song, Cheney's Got a Gun, go to my website. It's right there, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com, and you can download it. Hear it again. Let's see. So Cheney's at 29%. Pardon me, Bush doing a lot better. He's his approval on handling the economy, 39%. Why don't these guys get out of there? Damn. Here, this is off my website as well, peterwerbe.com. Dead-eyed dick tail filled with discrepancy. Hey, some of you hunters, give us a call, because there's been a lot of debate about whether Cheney broke hunting rules. And remember, at first, very typically, they tried to blame it on the man that got shot. He was in my way. It wasn't my fault. I just turned, shot, and there he was. 313-298-WRIF. I've never hunted. Done a lot of I've done target shooting and what have you, but I don't know what the deal is. Do you shoot a covey of quail on the ground, or are you supposed to let them take off? Because that the shot that hit him obviously was at a level shot. All right. This is from my website, peterwerbe.com. Dick Cheney's top 10 excuses for shooting fellow hunter Harry Whittington. Number 10, Cheney was sick and tired of Whittington's, hey, I'm having a heart attack jokes. That's number 10. Number 9, he was pushed over the edge by Dixie Chicks and Barbra Streisand blasting on the pickup truck stereo. Number 8, ongoing dispute over whether it's acceptable to torture quail before shooting them. Number 7 of Dick Cheney's top excuses, thought he saw Scooter Libby on the other side of the tree line. Number 6, he was bombed out of his gourd on Wild Turkey and Lone Star Beer. Number 5, companion's ill-advised decision to wear a MoveOn.org sweatshirt. And reason number 4 why he shot Harry Whittington was trying to impress Jodie Foster. I like that one. And number 3 reason, Whittington's repeated ribbing that Bush is actually the real president. Number 2, targeting scope on the rifle was made by Halliburton. And the number 1 excuse given by Dick Cheney for almost blowing away hunting companion Harry Whittington, because I'm the wartime vice president, damn it. All right. Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. His pal, GW, is coming to Detroit, actually Auburn Hills, and he's going to visit a solar cell plant tomorrow. And this is interesting. I wonder if he knows this. The plant he's going to, United Solar Ovonic, is owned by the father of the man who started the Radical Fifth Estate newspaper. Hey, how's that? That's a tip to some of you news hawks out there. But anyways, this is what a fraud. In the State of the Union, Bush called for investing more than $1.2 billion in the development of advanced batteries, hydrogen fuel cells, and alternative fuels to reduce the nation's reliance on foreign oil. There's no real intention on Bush's part to do that. He's an oil man through and through. He's fighting a war for oil in Iraq, essentially in Afghanistan for the same reason. Picking a fight with Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, although Chavez is doing pretty nasty back on his own, isn't he, in terms of picking a fight. But this is all window dressing. The amount of money allocated in Bush's budget, which essentially takes money from the disabled elderly and medical stuff for the poor and kids and on and on and on and on, and privileges the wealthy, the ultra wealthy, with more tax cuts that they don't need, and also hurts the people that are the most defenseless. And that's who bullies always go after. And there's a cut in research for alternative fuel. So they have absolutely no intention of going alternative in any way. Now, Chavez, this guy is, and now I don't say this critically either, a piece of work. When I was down in Venezuela, I was supposed to go to a big rally where he was going to speak at a big arena. But I decided to stay in and watch it on the hotel television, which I think was a good decision, because it was one of his short ones, only 2.5 hours. But today, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez warned Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, "Don't mess with me." I mean, this is too rich. After Rice described Venezuela as a menace to regional democracy in the midst of tense diplomatic relations between the two countries. Now, here's what Chavez says. Now, this is trash talking. This is so incredible. "Don't mess with me, Condoleezza. Don't mess with me, girl." I mean, this is too much. This is what international diplomacy has come down to. He said this during his weekly broadcast, and he kept referring to her. He offered her a kiss and jokingly referred to her as condolence. Right. The warning comes days after Rice described Venezuela as one of the biggest problems for the Western Hemisphere and promised to develop regional alliances as part of an inoculation strategy to expose what the State Department calls anti-democratic behavior in Venezuela. What is the evidence for this? What you can say this, and he talks about socialism, Chavez does, and he calls Bush Hitler. Remember I told you when I was down in Caracas at the Caracas Hilton, this fancy hotel, is fancier than a lot of Hiltons here in the United States. All over the hotel, there's big posters with a picture of Bush with a Hitler mustache, and it says underneath it, Bush Asesino, Bush Assassin. And they never got taken down. You know, if you put up any poster, like in a fancy hotel, let alone one that attacks the powerful or the wealthy or the ruling politician, it's gone. But these just stayed there in El Hilton, as it's called. But it's not clear to me how his nemesis, Chavez, is threatening the United States, how Chavez is anti-democratic within Venezuela, is anti-democratic or dangerous to other countries in South America. You note there has not been a single country within South America that said, "Oh, we're being threatened by him." They don't feel like that. They're talking about more and more regional alliances, pipelines of natural gas and oil across the continent. They like the idea that Chavez has set the standard now to reduce the level of imperial looting when these Western companies invest, and usually the host country got screwed pretty well, except for the upper elite of the host country. And that's who's pissed off at Chavez in Venezuela, about 23% of the people that like the deal the way things were arranged previously. That is, they live just like us. You go, pardon me, you go in Caracas and you see these, like we pass by these barrios that although they've improved in terms of medical care and government subsidized food and these literacy programs, absolutely incredibly still, you almost feel mortified going by them to know that you have such luxury in your life. I'm talking about myself now. Maybe I should just use the proper pronoun. I felt like that going by. The road would go literally 3 or 4 feet from their houses. And you could, your people are standing in the doorway, and it's all, you could, if the bus stopped, you could have a conversation with them. And this process is being, it's not being reversed. Nothing is happening to the rich elite, the European ancestry elite, because you go throughout most of Caracas and the little bit of the rest of Venezuela that I saw. This was at the end of January in this year, just a few weeks ago, and most people are brown skin. And then suddenly you take a subway ride on their beautiful, efficient, modern, quiet subway, which is 17 cents, and not like other cities that are raising their rates because they're so in debt, but 17 cents, and you go up to Altamira, this wealthy district, suddenly everybody's European, and they all hate Chavez. Did I tell you this when I came back? This one guy said, "We're like the Jews in Germany." I said, "Really? That's awful." He said, "Oh, yes." He said this, and they always start this. Venezuela used to be such a wonderful country. Everybody was happy. No one had any cares, but then Chavez came in, and everything's gone to hell. And I said, "So now you're in," this man spoke English. I said, "So now you're like a Jew in Germany, huh?" I said, "Have you lost your job? No. Have you, you've been put in a concentration camp?" I said, "You know, you ought to read a little more history before you use an analogy like that." And one of the things, let's see here. This is pretty interesting. The State Department, where was this in here? Oh yeah, diplomatic relations between the United States and Venezuela, the world's number 5 oil exporter, have been strained since Chavez accused the United States of plotting a coup that briefly ousted him in 2002. Do you think? I mean, you think the United States would do anything like that? Do you think George Bush would do anything like that? Well, they certainly got the go-ahead. They got immediate recognition, these coup plotters that overthrew the constitutional, democratically elected government of Venezuela in 2002. Can you say Chile in, 1973? When the United States plotted the overthrow, murder, and installation of a fascist general that lasted for how many years? Pinochet? All right, so the United States has a long history of this, and then Chavez came back. Now, normally, when there's been an illegal, unconstitutional coup carried out against the legitimate government, what does a government do? It arrests all the plotters. It puts them in jail. Generally, they're executed. You know how many people were put in jail? Zero. All of the press and all of the private held television stations are virulently anti-Chavez. In fact, they are wildly, I mean, they make Fox News, Foxhole News, look fair and balanced, given the level of the nature of the calumny that they lay on Chavez. And so his 21st century socialism that he talks about, his anti-imperialism, his opposition to globalization is based on bringing a standard of living to the Venezuelan people at a level that you and I still would just cringe at having to live in. So someone will have to explain to me how awful, pardon me, how awful Chavez is and what his crimes are. I like this. Chavez, a former soldier turned populist leader. Remember when we went to the dictionary and looked up what populist is? That's one of those phrases that sounds kind of suspicious. But the dictionary definition, and it is true in politics, is someone that supports the rights and power of the people. Someone that supports the rights and power of the people. The great masses of people. Now, what's the opposite of that? And what's George Bush? What's Dick Cheney? Dead-eyed Dick. They're corporatists. They run a government for the corporations, by the corporations, and of the corporations. And the corporations have separate and distinct issues and agendas and goals different from what you and I have as individual citizens. We're populist because we believe, I hope, except for the fascist third of you, who support corporatism for some reason or other, even though it's against your best interest, we support populism. We support the rights of the people, and we support the power of the people. And it's being tremendously eroded. Tremendously eroded. Now, one of the things that Chavez is doing, as you know, is sending cheap oil to the poor of the United States. I mean, they have a surplus of oil, and it all goes to the gas stations, Citgo. But also, one of the things they're doing is selling discounted heating oil to poor people in Delaware, in Philadelphia, Massachusetts, New York, Maine, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Connecticut. Chavez offered cheap fuel to the city of Chicago so they wouldn't have to raise their bus rates. I think it's like $2.50 now or something like that. If you're listening in Chicago, you can give us a call. Rather than accepting this fuel and perhaps even reducing prices, and mass transit, like in most cities, although not all, are used primarily by the poor. So this, again, is a cut into the people that can least afford it. And rather than saying, well, thank you, isn't that nice, they refused it. And the Republicans now, they suspect politics, not charity. It could be both. You think any other politicians maybe have dual motives? All right, let me look at the time. Rather than, all right, we'll do this. Let's take a first call, and then we'll take a break. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. I'm Peter Werby, and this is the Night Call Show. And hi, you're on the air. You're our first caller. Welcome. Hey, Douglas. Sorry, no, I didn't do it. All right, I see. I forget how to do this from week to week. It's Douglas from Chesterfield. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead. Go ahead, you're in the air. Yeah, hey.
I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
What's up with this Cheney shooting his friend in shoulder or face or whatever with his gun, and we got gun restrictions all over the United States?
I don't get it. What do you mean?
Hunting restrictions.
That's right. You are not supposed to shoot your hunting partner. That's one hunting restriction I support. How about you?
Oh, all for that.
Good.
But why can he get away with it? And we can't.
I don't know. What would happen? That's a very interesting question. What would happen, Douglas, if you shot somebody while hunting?
Oh, I'd feel... Do you know how bad I would feel if I did that?
Well, Cheney felt badly, too. Didn't he?
I mean, but he gets away with it.
Yeah, well, accidents will happen. I mean, I heard him. Remember, how's this? It's a moment I'll never forget, and it was one of the worst days of my life.
Whoa.
Did you think Dick was in the studio?
That sounded kind of creepy.
Well, I hate to say it, but the guy who's vice president is kind of creepy. All right, let me get somebody else here. This is interesting. Dino in Erie. Dino, hi, you're on the air. Erie, what is there, in Erie, Michigan?
Yes, sir, hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to understand the difference in religion around America and stuff, but being at Kroger's tonight with my wife, there's a woman fully dressed head to toe, knitted eye holes, you could see nothing but her hands. I think if I came into the store with a cold day like today with my Carhartts and a ski mask, there would be a problem.
Yeah, I would think so.
Why can she come in? Because her religion, she wants to come to America shop, and she needs to dress like Americans. What's the difference is all I want to know.
You know what, Dino? I'm willing to bet you that person was a native-born American. Here's what I'll tell you.
I don't know.
Well, I know. We don't know. And this is just supposition. Almost all of Middle Eastern immigrants that come here, for one thing, they know this is a secular country. They know that that dress like that is frowned upon. And at best, they wear, like scarves. I see a lot of women, when I'm visiting friends in Dearborn or going out there for restaurants or what have you. But the only people that I've seen in that full chadra or whatever they're called in the different parts of the Muslim world are generally worn by American Muslims. And I think it's, I know you're supposed to, and hey, people can beat me up on this. We're not being liberal enough. But it kind of creeps me out to have a person that's in virtually in like full disguise. In fact, you know what, Dino? There are laws about going masked in public. You cannot go around wearing you're just what you said. You can't go around wearing a mask.
Right. Not to interrupt, but my point is that's fine. If she wants to wear her religious clothes, what if she kidnapped my friend's child or she started shooting? What do I tell the FBI? What does she look like?
Well, I don't know. This is my laugh is cold ridden, as you can hear. I don't think that's a real big item. I don't think too many women in those full chadras have kidnapped anybody, but that would be that'd be a hell of an interesting little twist to a crime story that actually those instead of being you see three women all dressed like that and then all of a sudden they whip out some submachine, give us all the money. That sounds like Cheney, doesn't it? All right, thank you very much. Let's see what other people have to say about it. In France. They have said that there can't be any public display of religious paraphernalia. That means you can't even wear a headscarf as a religious sign to cover your head. You can't wear those Jewish skull caps, yarmulkes. You can't wear Muslim girls can't wear Muslim scarves. Kids can't wear big crosses. They want to keep religion out of the public sphere. One of the things that the right-wingers say, they're trying to kick religion out of the public square. And I say, well, they've got these places where people can do that kind of stuff. They're called churches and mosques and synagogues and all of that. And why are these people always trying to insert this into public life? Because we know historically what the result is of religion when it gets mixed with public life. It's always a hassle. And it's not Muslims and Christians. You ever hear of, what's the name of that country? Northern Ireland, for instance? Or numerous wars between Catholics and Protestants all throughout the Middle Ages, Shiites and Sunnis. Once it leaves religious establishments, there's always a problem. And for sure, whenever you commingle religion and a political state, look out. I mean, it's an absolute disaster. Because when politicians wrap themselves in religion, it's always awful, isn't it? All right. I'd like your opinion on this. So I say, keep religion out of the public square. And you say, oh, it's so terrible. Well, they got big spaces for all this. All right? I mean, you don't go to a lot of towns that you don't see, like, at least church. So it's not like they're going to be denied anything. And the Constitution says that you cannot deny the... here it is. I just happen to have my... Everybody has that, right? Their copy of the Bill of Rights. In number one. Isn't it in there about religion? Oh, yeah. This is number one. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. I was going for or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But isn't it interesting that these men living so long ago made these rules that they thought were important to stop all the abuses of Europe? Because Europe was this madhouse. This was a toxic culture that had been brought over here to the New World, slaughtered all these native people that knew how to live on the earth, and then began functioning in the same way here in the New World that it had in the old one, that had caused nothing but war and insanity and disease and environmental destruction and authoritarian rule. So out of nowhere, these people say, we're going to create, extraordinary. Pardon me. We're going to create a government and we're going to make rules. And nobody's going to be able to violate these rules because they're going to be set up in advance. And we have it in a document. We have the Constitution. Then they thought, we're not guaranteeing enough here. Because same kind of stuff that we suffered under the king and that many of us who came and were born in Europe and England suffered. So the very first thing, they didn't say freedom of speech. They didn't say freedom of the press. They didn't say the right of the people peacefully to assemble. They didn't say to petition the government for redress of grievances. That was not number one. The absolute number one Bill of Rights Amendment in the First Amendment was Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's how dangerous they perceived religion to be, even though some of them were Christians. I don't know what the percentage was. A lot of them were just with, well, forget all that. I think I'm going to do a little coughing. All right? In the meantime, you get calling. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Be right back.
You're listening to WRIF. A revolution in quitting smoking has arrived. We bring you a stop smoking gum that actually tastes good. Really good. Which should make quitting a little more pleasant. Nicorette Fresh Mint. It's the first and only stop smoking gum coated with a cool burst of mint flavor. Consumers prefer the taste 2-to-1 over any other stop smoking gum. Tastes great and fights cravings fast. Nicorette Fresh Mint. Start chewing, start quitting. Use as directed. Follow dosing schedule. Individual results may vary. Support program can improve success rate.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, "We eliminate the middleman"? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Divorce, custody, support. Three words that tell a man you have a serious problem. You can try to solve your problem by ignoring it, by calling some new lawyers who claim to suddenly be into men's rights, or by choosing a lawyer with a flip of a coin. Or you can tackle your problem with the experienced professionals at ADAM, the American Divorce Association for Men. You can call ADAM at 248-356-ADAM, and they'll answer your questions by phone at no charge. ADAM has been successfully representing white-collar professionals, business owners, doctors, blue-collar workers, and men just like you for over a decade. With ADAM, you get the advantages of a large law firm, but receive the attention and dedication of one experienced attorney who will handle your case from beginning to end. Because of its many years of experience, ADAM can design a strategy to help you protect your home, your property, your children, and your future. And remember, while others may claim to be the so-called new answer in men's rights, ADAM, through dedication, knowledge, and experience, keeps proving they're the right answer when it comes to protecting men in divorce. Call ADAM today at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
Sending money is easy at Western Union because you can use cash or your debit card at participating agent locations. So the next time your daughter calls with a crazy story like,
Daddy, a bookworm got loose in my book bag and ate up all my money.
Remember, you don't always need cash to send cash at participating Western Union agent locations. All you need is your debit card and PIN number. For every story, Western Union, the fastest way to send money worldwide. Restrictions apply. Visit a participating agent location for details.
I was looking for an opportunity to earn money from home. Then I heard about IncomeAtHome.com. That's IncomeATHome.com. You owe it to yourself. Log on to IncomeAtHome.com. Enter your email address, view the online presentation, and decide for yourself if this is for you. Order your information kit and get started right away. There's no cold calling, no selling soap to your friends or family. If you're looking for a chance to earn money from home, this could be it. IncomeAtHome.com. IncomeATHome.com.
Gentlemen, the Pantheon in Dearborn is Michigan's most prestigious adult entertainment club. All new and better than ever with new daily specials. Enjoy $1.50 beer specials Monday through Friday. Saturdays, grab 75-cent beers from 11 till 7. Every Wednesday is ladies' night with $3 Cosmos, apple martinis, sex on the beach, and more. Now, catch Foxy Boxing every Monday and Wednesday in the brand new boxing ring on center stage.
The Pantheon, open 11 a.m. till 2 a.m. Monday through Saturday and Sunday from 7 p.m. till 2 a.m. on the corner of Michigan Avenue and Oakman in Dearborn.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual when he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the Total Transformation. The program that helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
If you're looking for more capability in life, look to the Jeep Liberty. The 2006 Liberty has a lot more to offer than just powerful go-anywhere four-wheel drive capability. For starters, you can get an available four-speed automatic transmission, power locks and power windows, six-speaker stereo with AM-FM CD player, and with a 3.7-liter V6 engine and CommandTrack four-wheel drive system, Liberty will get you anywhere you need to go. Now qualified returning Daimler Chrysler employee lessees can lease a Liberty Sport for just $139 a month for 24 months with $1,967 due at signing. Tax, title, and license extra. Get the capability and features you want in the 2006 Jeep Liberty. See your Chrysler and Jeep superstores today. Call 1-888-299-JEEP for lease example details. Residency restrictions apply. Offer requires dealer contribution and a lease through Chrysler Financial. Must take retail delivery by 2-28-06. Chrysler and Jeep are registered trademarks of Daimler Chrysler.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. I was just saying that we don't want religion intermingled with the state, and that's interesting. You know, I never noticed that before tonight, even though I'd read the Bill of Rights. How many times? How many times have you looked at it? But number one, Congress will make no law respecting the establishment of religion. They're frightened of it. They understood the dangers of publicly expressed religion. It always turns out badly. It's got a bad history. Number of emails came into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Brian from Windsor writes in, I realize that your program isn't a music session, but how about playing the Beastie Boys in A World Gone Mad, since every lyric in the song backs all that you say? That song was pulled off the air so fast it made me sick. Freedom of expression, lots of luck. Yeah, sometimes I've thought about that, just doing a show that's just playing music, and every once in a while come in and talk. Somehow music seems to do it really great. Now, here is a statement from the fascist third. We were talking about Hugo Chavez, which I said is a populist leader, P-O-P-U-L-I-S-T, populist. And populist, dictionary definition, is someone supporting the rights and power of the people. Here's what this guy writes in. A government for the people is called communism. Whew. This is a scary guy. A government for the people is called communism. It's one line. I'm not, taking it out of context or something like that. So I'm not sure what he would see. What does he say about a government for the corporations? I guess that's it. A government for the corporations, which we have now, solely. I mean, it's a 100% racket. Most governments have always been rackets for the rich, and people have always had to eke out little bits of support for what we need to live our lives. But a government for the people is called communism. And I would say a government for the corporations, what we have now, is called fascism. In fact, that's corporatism. That's what Mussolini called it. So I guess the choice is pretty simple there, huh? All right, a couple more here I'll just tell you. Jacob, listening in Oulu, Finland, as usual. He says, a great morning here. And he said, you sound great. Thanks a lot. It's on the Arctic Circle. Did I say that? Gary in Windsor says, your website's link on the picture of you and Cindy Sheehan in Caracas isn't working. I'd like to see some of the pictures you took from the World Social Forum because I wasn't able to make it to Caracas. Hopefully the link will be fixed soon. Actually, that went to a Yahoo News feature, which I can't even remember what it's about. Some of those links, when you see links on my site, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, and they're broken or something like that, email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I don't have a staff, so I depend on you. Gary also says, I really enjoyed the Cheney Had a Gun song. It's sure to go number one with a bullet. And that song sung to very much like the Aerosmith, Janie's Got a Gun. I'll play that again when? People don't like to hear things twice, right? But I'll play it in a little while if you haven't heard it. All right, let's go back to our phones, we're gonna talk to Nick in Toledo. Nick, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for calling in.
Well, my question was, where does the government draw the line between a cult and interfering with a cult and a religion that just practices regularly? Like, let's say with like the people in Waco, and then face like the Scientology thing. Like, Scientology is a complete cult. Like, people having to throw money to become higher up in the religion and stuff, and Waco where...
Well, gee, any religion that does that is a cult. You're absolutely right. Hey, look, Nick, there's an old saying. It says, they belong to a cult. You belong to a sect. I belong to a religion. So, do you remember, what was that, that there was this guy that was killed in a kind of way that was done pretty frequently a couple thousand years ago, and there was this little small sect created around him. What the hell was that called?
Christianity?
Oh, yeah, Christianity, right. So, it all depends on where you are in the scheme of things. I mean, think about... you know, the Mormon religion and its tenets, and what was done to them. Are you familiar all at, outside of off of Charlevoix? There's an island called Beaver Island. Ever hear of that? Fair sized island. I've sailed there before, and there was a colony of Mormons there, and there was a they're trying to live their lives, do their polygamy thing, and all that. And the righteous citizens of Michigan, I can't remember when this was, 1840s, 1850s. They got some boats, came over there and attacked them. I can't remember the story. I don't know whether they killed them all, killed some of them, killed them all, or just drove them off. But one of the reasons, of course, that the Mormons wound up in Utah is because they were driven pillar to post by the good Christian citizens who said, they're not following our religion. They've developed a cult. So we got to be careful. You got to be careful. On the other hand, we don't want to, you know, give anybody a bad time because they've got religious ideas we think are goofy.
Yeah, I just want to know like where the government decides to draw the line on where to step in. Like, I can understand the Waco thing where they're going to like hurt a bunch of people, but I think it's kind of ridiculous where they can let some of these religions go. I mean, but it's not a bad thing, but it's just they decide to say one religion is a cult and another religion is actually a religion. I mean.
I got you. All right. Thank you. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hey, we're big near Toledo. Here's Ryan. Ryan, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I was about to say, Pete, Toledo's in the house tonight.
Okay.
It's funny. I think you might have touched on a pretty good discussion topic, and that would be good songs that are applicable to the Bush administration. I always thought that Dead Kennedys' Kill the Poor was a pretty good anthem for everything that's been going down the last couple of years in this country.
We got to actually start recycling some of these old classics from the 60s and the 70s, too.
Yeah, well, you know, it all comes back around. It's just like history, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
I had just had a couple points real quick I want to knock out. First of all, the question about if Cheney would be charged. I believe the issue is whether or not he would be covered by executive privilege, which, of course, has been a big issue the entire administration. Since the guy didn't die, all they can really bring is a civil suit, and the executive is not subject to a civil suit until he's out of office. Now, if the guy had died, there might be some question as to whether an involuntary manslaughter charge could have been brought. But, again, that would be subject to whether that would qualify as a high crime or misdemeanor. Under the meaning in the Constitution. But I also want to touch on, you mentioned last week that Rumsfeld had compared Chavez to Hitler.
Right.
And there was actually a poll on MSNBC.com, and 74% of Americans said that was an erroneous comparison. And then, of course, kind of keeping with that third theory that you had, 25% of the people in said that was a fair comparison. And
I missed it. In other words, 75% of the people that responded to the poll said that a comparison of Bush with Hitler was inappropriate.
Chavez to Hitler.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, because Rumsfeld did that. But also, you got to remember, Chavez keeps comparing Bush to Hitler.
Right.
Which I think is inappropriate, too.
Right.
And go ahead.
The larger thing is that Rumsfeld and all these guys, they love, at any chance they get, they love to compare the enemies of the United States to Hitler.
Right.
To Germany. And to me, it's just such an insulting, such a grotesque comparison to make. There's absolutely no comparison, and it's an insult to everybody. It's an insult to people who survived the Holocaust, anybody in any way associated with that war. It's just a total slap in the face that they would even think to compare Saddam Hussein or Chavez to the greatest monster of all time.
Well, if you think about it, Ryan, I mean, these men, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, have no credibility whatsoever. Everything they've pronounced publicly has been exposed as a lie. But think about Rumsfeld's analogy. He said that when someone said to him, he said, well, Chavez was elected, and Rumsfeld said, so was Hitler. So was Hitler. But this figure was mentioned. This won't be so hard because the figure itself I've mentioned several times tonight. What percentage of the German people elected Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
I've said the figure in other contexts tonight. Do you, any idea or any memory or any knowledge of what it was? A third.
You know what?
A third.
Yeah.
That's who elected Adolf Hitler. A third of the German people voted for him. The fascist third. In that election, I think I got my years right, 1932, the left, the combined vote total of the communists and the socialists were over 50%. And Hitler was a minority party, but because of a whole lot of things, was able to come to office, and then we know what happened next. On the other hand, Chavez's popularity now is 77%. 77%. So the comparison is really ridiculous.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for having joined us. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Donna. Donna's in Chesterfield, and you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
I want to know why Dick Cheney gets away with shooting someone. My ex-husband spent 3 months in jail because his girlfriend shot himself.
Really? Well, I mean, it was, as far as we know, an accident. Here's what...
He spent 3 months in jail.
Wow.
And he lost his job. I have three kids. And it's really bad. Lost his guns. I'm not really worried about guns, but
well, you know, the deal is, Donna, that nothing ever happens to the rich and powerful, no matter how many bad mistakes they make. Whether they enter wars that they had no business doing and they've lied, whether they've made bad business decisions, and on and on and on. They have the privilege of power, and that's why they know they can say or do anything. You'd think anybody with a wit of decency would see that that the vast majority of American people do not approve of what you are doing in the country, and at such a critical point would resign. I mean, why the hell doesn't Dick Cheney go back to Wyoming or Texas or wherever the hell he lives?
Man.
Yes, that's what I say. All right, I got to take a break. Thank you, Donna. And there was another little thing there. Cheney. We'll think about it when we come back. All right, join me. Open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com. Now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months, for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF. Reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. You're listening to WRIF.com.
beef and fire-roasted veggies.
Wow, that is a fiesta. Sounds...
Mooey delicious. Chili Hotline.
Hey, I'm into kickboxing.
Wow, exercising your rights.
And my lefts, so I need to stay lean.
Stag's Silverado Lean Beef Chili, 97% fat-free.
They do that?
Chili is all they do. You can beef up and beef up.
I love it.
Stag Chili, the chili chili lovers love.
Tobacco companies make a product that's responsible for about one death every 8 seconds. Which means another person will probably die in the time it takes me to tell you that tobacco companies make a product that's responsible for about one death every 8 seconds. And that means another person probably just died while I was telling you that another person will probably die in the time it takes me to tell you that tobacco companies make a product that's responsible for about one death every 8 seconds. And that means that during this commercial, somewhere in the world, tobacco companies' products killed about 4 people.
You found truth on your FM dial.
Attention all rap, rock, R&B, country, pop, gospel, reggaeton producers and songwriters. Get ready for the largest music event to ever hit the Midwest. That's right, Get Seen, Get Signed Music Conference 06 is an 11-city tour, and it's coming to your city.
Have your music heard by the decision makers in the industry. Sony, Warner, Capitol, Virgin, Atlantic, Universal, ASCAP, Interscope, and more.
Don't forget, one lucky person will receive a cash prize of $10,000 along with a recording contract. Again, 877-M-U-Z-I-C-06. That's music with a Z.
Come see celebrity appearances and be a part of the VIP after party. Seats are limited, so call now for audition time.
Only the best will be accepted to attend the main conference. It's our event, but it's your show.
Vendor space available. Call 877-M-U-Z-I-C-06.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. At 1 a.m., I'll be airing a couple of interviews that I recorded previously, including one with Frank Joyce, an old buddy of mine, a long-time public relations director for the United Auto Workers, in fact, responsible for hiring me in to the IE America Radio Network. I did a nationally syndicated show from about 2000 through 2003, and he's been to Vietnam recently, a couple-week tour, he and his wife. And he was also there in 1970. So I asked him to compare it all. That's about an hour from now. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Pardon me. We've been talking about Dead Eye Dick and just what this whole incident represents with him wounding his hunting buddy. I was going to let it go, I said at the beginning of the show, and now I see Time and Newsweek are coming out with front page stories bringing forth more information. Now, why would Cheney have done some of the things that he did? I was trying to remember right before the break. I was trying to remember. I couldn't remember something. I also couldn't remember why we were talking about religion, but then I did as well. Things come to me. Anyways, pardon me. Briggs, and excuse my cough, got the Michigan cold, but hot tea is keeping on. Briggs writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Maybe you could pose the question, actually, Briggs, you are, why the Vice President of the United States is drinking at all? I mean, since we're at war with 140,000 soldiers standing in harm's way, a mass murderer responsible for killing thousands of American citizens running free. Oh, killed thousands. Oh, I see. He's talking about Osama bin Laden. I thought he was saying that was Cheney. Anyways, constantly being told we should fear for our safety. Well, I don't know, Briggs. I had a drink with dinner, and same thing is true. I got troops in harm's way. A mass murderer is still running free. I'm going to bring him back, dead or alive. Remember that? Maybe what we should have done was remember, every once in a while they have like America, what was that? That was years ago. America held captive day one and all that. So we should have had some logo like Bin Laden still free day, what is it? 309, I don't know, thousand, you know, day like 1100 or something like that. In fact, Bin Laden, new tape just showed up, said he'll never be taken alive. And tweaked Bush's nose, saying that, yeah, you're the guy that said mission accomplished, right? Man. Anyway, Cheney drinking. Now, Remember how many hours went by before all of this was reported, and he Cheney had some cockamamie story about why he didn't know. I thought it was important for the woman whose ranch it was to contact the press. And then they sent the story off to one of the big outlets in the country, the Corpus Christi paper. Anybody have any sense that maybe they wanted a lot of alcohol to get out of his blood before they actually got the press in on it? See, that's the deal. You're saying, oh, you know, typical cynicism, pardon me, typical anti-Cheney remark. Yeah, but one of the things that happens when you have secret government, you can only think the worst. That's why, for instance, if the Constitution says that there shall be no warrantless searches, and the government, in order to expedite warrants for terrorist situations, sets up a secret court, which is pretty wild to begin with and pretty inconsistent with American principles, but has it, and says all the president has to do is come to the secret court, get a warrant, and in fact, you can get a warrant after you've begun the tapping, so you don't have to wait around. But Bush says he's tapping people's lines, only those that are a danger to the United States. Well, we know full well they tapped so many people's lines that the FBI was being overwhelmed with leads that turned out to be absolutely nothing. So American citizens are being tapped, and we're expected to trust the word of these people that we've already found out have lied about the reason that we went to war in Iraq. So why should we suspect that we're being told the truth here? Why shouldn't we suspect that maybe who's being surveilled are opponents of the government? The Democratic Party, the anti-war movement, the press. Well, he wouldn't do that. Well, do we know that? How do we know? See, the road is open. Even if you're one of the few people left supporting Bush and his policies and his government, it would make sense for there to be a transparency so people wouldn't suspect these bad things. If you think not, I think all these bad things are going on. But if you don't think any of them are, and I'm just being partisan, you would be fighting for the most open government possible as opposed to the most closed, secretive government possible, which is a hallmark of Bushco, the Bush regime, right? Because this is hurting them. But they're reflexively secret. They're reflexively secret because they're anti-democratic. They're not anti-democratic party. They're anti-democratic, first off, as personality types. They're authoritarian personality types. And they give, what do you call that? They give a nod or whatever to the official forms of democracy. But everything that we've seen that they've done smacks of authoritarian rule. All right. Let's go back to your calls. 313-298-WRIF. And let's go on this Cheney thing a little bit more. In fact, I'm surprised none of you hunters have weighed in on this. There's always accidents. That's comes with the territory and hunting. But I don't know. You got comments. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Greg in Rochester. Greg, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
How you doing, Mr. Werby?
Good. Thanks.
I listen to you all the time, and it's a great show.
Well, thank you. Can you turn the radio completely off?
Sure, I can.
Okay.
And
yeah, because we're on a 7-second delay at least. All right, Greg, go ahead. You're on the air.
As far as, hello?
Yeah. Hi. Go ahead.
As far as Cheney, I don't know why he is not under scrutiny, because if that were to happen to you and I,
yeah,
we'd be in jail right now.
Well, I don't know. You think that's true, Greg? I mean, if there's an accident, a hunting accident, and it's an accident,
right? You got to understand too that, and I think I read in the paper where there was a guy that did actually shoot his hunting partner.
Uh huh.
And he was in jail for 3 days under investigation with questioning and such.
Right.
But, you know, that I don't understand where he gets the political, upper echelon?
Yeah, the political cover. Well, part of it is that he does have some executive immunity. I mean, the vice president What was wait a minute? Who do? What was I forgot who was who? Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. Who the hell was who here? Wait a minute. All right, thank you very much. How come my brain is not in gear now? The Alexander Hamilton must have been the vice president. Aaron Burr wasn't. Who shot who? That's always, you know, this they've talked about this about 20 times since this has happened. I don't know why my brain isn't functioning here. All right, here is Al in Inkster. Al, hi, it's Peter Werby. Do you remember who shot who?
Aaron Burr was shot by Alexander Hamilton as a result of a duel.
Right, I knew that. So, and Hamilton, who appears on one of our... Isn't that funny? I can't even remember.
$10 bill.
$10 bill.
He right. founded the national banking system.
He must have been a communist.
Capitalist, actually, if he founded the banking system.
Yeah, there
had he been a communist, he would have founded the credit union system.
Now, some of these people think, though, that the Federal Reserve System is sort of a commie plot.
Well, he didn't found the Federal Reserve.
I know.
National Bank.
All right, go ahead. What's up?
When I was taught to hunt, I was always taught to be sure of my target.
Yeah?
My grandfather lost his eye to a hunting accident similar to what happened to Dick Cheney, where he was shot by an inexperienced hunter following a bird.
Well, now, that's all that Cheney does. He doesn't have any other hobbies. He's, kill crazy. And did I say that on the air about how he was asked if he wanted to go sailing? He said, I've never been sailing.
Not too bad. Sailing's a wonderful thing.
I know.
You know, you capture nature. Nature pushes you from A to B. You know, it's nice.
And it's good to do during non-hunting season.
You can do it during hunting season, too, if you got the warm weather clothing.
Yeah, you do. But what were you? What I see up on the board here, you were bringing up the idea of Cheney being breath.
Drug and alcohol tested. I mean, he's on the job. He's on the clock, basically. My dad told me, when I was a kid, the president's on the clock all the time.
Yeah, we're
so
paying.
He's on the job.
Yeah, we're paying for his hunting trips. We're paying for this whole hospital to travel with him.
I have an accident at work. The next thing you know, the supervisor throws me in an office until they can get me down to the clinic for drug and alcohol testing.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow.
So, why wasn't he thrown into the,
Well, it's
down for drug. The woman, Catherine Thompson, I think her name is, that owned the ranch.
Right.
She originally said, well, we were serving Dr. Pepper with lunch, and then, it became one beer, who's drank under a shady tree long before he went shooting.
Yeah, I just had Lone Star, and that was all, and that was four hours before we went hunting. Yeah. All right, Al, thank you very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here is Andy in Toledo. Andy, hi. A lot of people. Are you guys all in the same house in Toledo?
Oh, no. I'm on my way home, actually, from Fraser from a hockey game.
Oh, okay.
And I was listening. I was just calling in to say most people, whenever there's any type of hunting accident, loses their hunting privileges.
Really?
Yes. My uncle lost his privileges for a long period of time because he was bow hunting and accidentally shot somebody. It was a bird hunter, and he didn't really pay attention. He hasn't had his license, and I think now.
Well, also, we know that Cheney didn't have all the proper documentation for being for hunting. He was minus like a little minor piece. Subsequently paid $7 to get this some certificate or other. But
yeah. Certificates for both aren't that expensive. To tell the truth, like you said, but I don't understand it. I'm not much of a bird hunter. I mostly deer hunt myself.
Uh-huh.
But the little I know about bird hunting, you're normally side by side within a 5 to 10 yard range.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be, one person takes the left side, one person takes the right side. Wherever the bird jumps, that's where you take your shot. Whoever's side gets it. So I can't see how it would be the other person's fault at all, and why would he even be taking a shot at that low of an angle on somebody else's side?
I was going to say, he was headed at shoulder level. I don't know, did you hear my thing about the reasons, that the 10 top reasons why he shot his hunting partner?
Yes, I did catch that.
Maybe there was one of them there. I don't know.
It had to be.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us from Toledo. And here's John. John's in Detroit. John, hey, it's Peter Werby on WRIF, and you're on the air with me.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Yeah, it was Burr was the vice president, actually, that shot Hamilton.
Aaron Burr was the vice president?
Yeah, Hamilton better know him, but it happens that Burr was the VP.
And what was, but was Hamilton ever the vice president too?
No, he actually wasn't. But Secretary of the Treasury, I mean, he had an influence where he obviously was better commemorated than Burr ever was. And Burr suffered the ignominy of...
They don't ever say, I got my allowance in my hand, so I actually have a... few 20s here, but...
Hamilton's on the 10, yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that.
There's Jackson,
there.
Indian killer, right, yeah. Okay, okay.
That should come out. But anyway, keep sharing the messages you brought back from Venezuela, the ultimate perspective, because as ludicrous as this whole Cheney affair is, and you, I think, do well to continue to point out how essentially illegitimate in every respect our government is, and how they're making the U.S. a pariah and of the world for all kinds of good reasons. We need to focus on the positive solutions and alternatives, and you're one of the few effective channels around here for doing it, so keep putting out the solutions. And
yeah, you know, I'll tell you, John, and some of my friends who are listening are probably a little curious, because I'm so contrary that I have lots of criticism. I wouldn't say lots, but I have criticisms of the Chavez government and some of their policies and how they're dealing with industrialization and mineral extraction and all of that. That's for them to deal with internally. And there's great debate about it. And there is the opposition within the country, not the right wing opposition, but the critics that have some of the same criticisms that I do. They're listened to and considered, and nothing happens to them.
Indeed. Yeah, they have more of a true democracy for all the flaws of Hugo Chavez. And the world knows it. And this is always... been the case that increasingly that those who oppose the U.S. are regarded as righteous for that alone, but in many cases we hear about many of the innovations in Brazil and all kinds of progressive governments that are coming out ever more against our retarded policies in this country. But we should focus too on the activities, the healing centers like Dr. Bob's and Woodward and other activities of the Greens and many the domestic activities that will put us in solidarity with the progressive governments around the world.
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately, a number of people say to me, and particularly younger people, say, what can we do? I mean, they look back on other periods of activism like the 60s or the 30s, and it all looked like it was right there. You know, Students for a Democratic Society in the 60s or the unions in the 30s, and they want to be able to function powerfully in the world to bring about the idea that we're not going to be stuck with the way things are hung together now, because it's not working real well at all on any level. And there's a lot looming up in the future that could make things a lot worse. But one of the things that struck me about the Chavez government is they have this mechanism called these Bolivarian circles. Bolivar was the liberator of the national hero of Venezuela, and a liberator of a number of the countries in South America. And these Bolivarian circles are really no more than just community organizations where people begin meeting face to face, not watching leaders on television, not communicating by email, although they may do that as well, but actually sitting down within their own communities, figuring out what they would like to see it look like, how they would like to see resources allocated, how they would like to do everything from live peacefully in the world to protect the environment, and then that begins to filter upwards. So, and if people are saying, well, that's pretty, not real clear, a little indistinct, not me a great leader. So those are the kind of mechanisms that we have to figure out for ourselves. But as long as we're approaching the world as single individuals against this massive concentration of power and wealth, we're never going to get anywhere. And means we have to learn new forms of organization. In the 30s, our grandfathers developed the unionization movement to bring, to get the foot of bosses off their neck and share a little of the wealth that they were producing in the factories every day. And in the 1960s, we saw civil rights groups and anti-war groups and feminists and other kinds of groups that were saying, hey, let's realize that that we're people within this society that have legitimate goals, and some of them are recognized, some of them they're still fighting for. All right, John, thanks, appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF, and here's another call. This is from Brian in Livonia. Brian, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I'm a first time caller.
Welcome.
And I've been listening for about 3 years. Anyway, on your website, you posted a biography of Cheney.
Yeah.
And I looked on the Fifth Estate website, the CBC.
Right.
Yeah. They show it in its entirety. I found it interesting.
You could watch. Oh, I didn't know that. You could link to it, and on their site, you could watch the whole Dick Cheney.
Yeah. The whole thing.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's great.
They had a bunch of other documentaries also.
Let me just tell people quickly. If you go to my site, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, I had somebody say, well, you're always pushing your website. I don't sell anything there. It's got information there. I've got up there now a link to the Canadian Broadcasting Company, CBC, documentary about Dick Cheney. It is absolutely astounding. Now, this is mainstream government documentary, all right? And what is shown on that? It was shown on Canadian television. If that would have been shown here, Cheney would have been back running Halliburton instead of being the vice president. But I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I just want to so you could tell your listeners, because it was, I don't know, they played that during the election. I don't know. I think everybody went crazy or something.
All right. Well, thank you for calling for the first time. Call us again. I appreciate it. Oh, right. The reason I sometimes go like that, things are not set. I just turned off my own mic. Things are not set up well here. I hope none of the engineers are listening. This is always designed by engineers and not on-air people. So I'm looking at the screen, which has all of you callers listed, and I'm kind of looking through the mic stuff. So it's sometimes hard for me to say. All right, who cares about that? Let's get rolling. Here is, I think it's Toner. Is that your name?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? Yeah, I just had a quick question about the welfare situation in the States. I go to the store like anyone else. I work 40 hours. I don't like my job. It's not bad. And I see people buying food stamps. They come in with nice cars, nice clothes, but they still use food stamps, state aided, to buy porterhouse steaks. Why can't they work like the rest of us?
Well, first off, the only people that are getting it, people are if they're buying expensive food, they're not doing well by their family. I mean, most of that. What do you think, Toner? You think that represents 1% or 50% or 100% of people that are receiving food stamps?
I can't give a percent.
Well, it's probably pretty low. I mean, for one thing, years ago I was a welfare worker, and within every system, there's a certain amount of people, as we know, that that are abuse a system. Usually, it's pretty low, and they think that welfare fraud is very low. There's not like it used to be. There's no able-bodied men on welfare. Most of it is women with dependent children, and work. I don't know where. I don't think there is work. And would most people rather get food stamps than work? You can't live with just food stamps. There's not enough there. All right, thanks. Let's see. Should we grab another call? We should indeed. Here is Steve in Ypsilanti. Steve, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
There's another thing, too. Everybody seems to have forgotten. Bobby Knight, then coach of Indiana basketball team, shot accidentally a hunting partner in the shoulder.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What happened to him? Nothing.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But anyway, General Motors is in serious trouble, and Ford is right behind General Motors. Today's paper, on Sunday, February 19th, the Free Press front cover best describes what is happening with General Motors and their crisis, whether or not they're going to survive. And Fortune magazine, February, front cover covers also about General Motors. And if Delphi goes out in March 30th deadline, that could also cripple General Motors.
Sure. Dale, it's going to be interesting to see what Steve Miller does. And we're not talking about the Steve Miller band here, folks. We're talking about Steve Miller, the CEO of Delphi, that's talking about cutting wages by, 60% or something like that? How come these guys can't keep it together? We say the economy's going well, and the stock market's over 11,000, and we're allegedly out of this recession. And where's the money being made? Is industrialism just dead, and we're all going to be having low-paid service jobs?
One-way free trade is what hurts.
Yeah, it does. It does. Our balance of trade is so out of whack.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. That's one of the things that's creating a situation. Man, what a cold. All right, here's Stella in Hamtramck. Stella, hi. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Doing great.
Sounds like I have your cold.
Uh-oh.
You know, I don't like hunting. I don't understand the thrill in killing little things, you know. But, you know, if these filthy, rich Texas Republicans want to shoot each other in an isolated area, why should we care, you know?
Well, that's one of the things I have on my website. I said, at least this time they're shooting their own.
And the guy's a lawyer on top of it. So, you know, what I think is insane is that we're selling our ports to Arab countries.
Yeah. Well, somebody else was going to talk about that. John, if you're on the, you're still on hold, don't hang up. Yeah, well, we're not selling it, at all. I can't find this story. I mean, it was already owned by a foreign company.
Was it?
Yeah, it was owned by a British company. If I had any order to all the stuff that's laying out here, it would, I could find this for you. It was an English company that owned it all, and it sold it to this, big corporation from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. But listen, why would you be worried, Stella? I just saw, what's his name? Without stuff in front of me, my memory is so bad. Chertoff, what the guy that's head of Homeland Security.
Right.
He assured us that there was no security difficulty whatsoever with this Arab Emirate corporation owning controlling our ports.
Oh, okay. He's such a responsible guy. I'll take his word.
Yeah, he's the guy that told us that everything was all right in New Orleans.
I know. He's an idiot. and here the NSA is spying on us. Our borders are open. And don't we have any control over the port? Can't we say they can't buy it?
There is a process. And, to tell you the truth, I don't think that there's like any quote danger. These people in Dubai are down with the U.S. program. We have base there and everything like that. And but what it's talking about is more and more. What's really significant here? It's just more and indicative of more and more U.S. assets that are owned by foreign companies.
Yeah, we're losing our country. What is that Dylan song that sounds like it was written for Bush? Is it Master of War?
Yeah. Become me masters of war. I won't even try to sing it even without. How come I can't find my story on that? All right. Thank you, Stella. Thanks for calling us. I appreciate it. Some open lines for you if you've been trying. 313-298-WRIF. Here's John in St. Clair Shores wants to bring up the same issue. Hi, John. How are you?
Oh, pretty good, Peter. Yourself?
Good, good, good.
Yeah, I'm from St. Clair Shores, but I'm on my way home from work. I work the evening shift out in Rochester.
Okay.
And the Bush administration, I have become so disgusted with just about everybody in it that it's hard to believe anything that anybody in the administration has got to say.
Yeah.
And, it's very sad events because originally I did vote for Bush the first go around and, I did it the second time and, he's just stumbling along and I would like him just to stay in the White House for the remaining 2 years, maybe take bowling up down in the basement there and, get involved in the Easter egg hunt and the T-ball tournament that he puts on. But I don't want him, you know, I don't think the image that he's created throughout the world is very good. I mean, it doesn't appear that anybody worldwide really likes the Bush administration. I don't think they have that much against Americans. They might have, but I think Bush has created a real problem for Americans throughout the whole world.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we haven't talked about, and that is the whole situation with these cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad and what's going on, which, I mean, they're actually getting worse and worse. More and more people are dying. The United States is now becoming the focus of the anger of these protesters. And probably to most of us, we're thinking, well, you know, come on, settle down. It's just a damn cartoon. But what's occurred and what this is representative of is all the issues that the Bush administration has thrust into the face of the Muslim world by the invasion of the Middle East and what looks like the continuing desecration of everything that looks important to Muslim people. And when you start, now there are more and more of these images from Abu Ghraib from a couple of years ago are starting to come out. So when we see them, I don't think they're rioting over cartoons. I think that they're totally pissed off, and we've created a situation where we've made more and more people angry at us. I'm just thankful that more hasn't happened directly in this country, and extraordinarily fearful that it will.
Yeah, I've got a feeling that the worst is yet to come. I have to admire one thing about the Muslim people, and that their belief is very strong. You know, I'm a Catholic, okay?
Yeah.
And I just wonder if the Catholic faith is as strong as a Muslim faith. Because there are about a billion Muslims in the world.
Something like that, yeah.
And I'll tell you one thing, they stick together pretty good.
They do. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. And by the way, you may have heard that story. This is another thing that just goes all through the Arab and Muslim and Middle Eastern world. Yeah, investigators for the United Nations essentially said Guantanamo Bay is a torture camp violating all international principles of law. And they said it should be shut down and either try its detainees quickly or free them. The vast majority of people at Guantanamo Bay are not these dangerous terrorists, as Scott McClellan, the press secretary for Bush, would have it, or even Secretary of War Rumsfeld. But rather, these were people that got scooped up on the battlefield. There was the invasion by the United States because they had played in Afghanistan, because they had played host to Osama bin Laden. And as a country that was under attack, whether it was a good country or bad country doesn't matter, its army fought back against the people attacking, which happened to be our soldiers. It doesn't make them terrorists. That means that they were fighting in an army. They weren't, what were they called, enemy combatants or anything like that. There were also any number of people that just were turned over to our erstwhile allies there and then handed over to the United States. So if these people have committed crimes, hey, why aren't they being tried? Why are these people going to be held forever in these conditions that the United Nations have declared ordered or condoned abusive practices, and they should be brought to justice, the people that involved in it, and that they ought to be called for American personnel to be trained in international standards for the treatment of detainees. I mean, this is the level to which the Bushco has brought this country. We're condemned by the world body. You go, oh, it's just the United Nations. Hey, it was the United Nations that Bush was trying to get to sanction his illegal, lying invasion of Iraq. Remember? So he must think something of it. Now, here's McClellan. These are dangerous terrorists that we're talking about who are there. Well, are they? Again, we got to trust them. If they are, why aren't they brought to trial? Why aren't they brought to trial? And then also, what's read across the Muslim world are more Abu Ghraib photos. Here is just a quick, very quick inventory of what the new releases were. 1,325 images of detainee abuse. 1,325 images of prisoners being abused by our troops. This is Support Our Oops, right? Support Our Oops at Abu Ghraib. 93 video files of detainee abuse. They're taking videos of this. 660 images of adult pornography. 546 images of dead Iraqi detainees. And 29 images of soldiers in simulated sexual acts. I guess these were the ones that were a little modest. They're only 29 of those. 660 actual adult pornography. Did these guys do anything else there, these men and women, other than abuse prisoners and take pornographic shots of themselves? And what's inherent in that is the arrogance that this could be done without anything happening, without any consequences. That this was not a few bad apples. This was policy. And what it turns out to be is American commanders in Iraq are expressing grave concerns that overcrowded Abu Ghraib, this is now, has become a breeding ground for extremist leaders and a school for terrorist foot soldiers. One American commander said, Abu Ghraib is a graduate-level training ground for the insurgency. Another called it Jihad University. So right now, remember, we were supposed to stop terrorists. This is why Bush Co. said we were going into Iraq. One of the reasons we were going to stop terrorism. Well, just like has been said 100 times before, terrorists are being created. And here, the United States is running Jihad University. Thank you, George Bush.
This is WRIM.com.
Right on, you rock.
Here at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
we're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our final segment. A lot of time for your calls, though. Here's what Jon Stewart said on The Daily Show about the Cheney situation. Don't let your kids go hunting with the vice president. I don't care what kind of lucrative contracts they're trying to land or energy regulations they're trying to get lifted. He'll shoot them in the face. That's pretty funny. The comedians sure have had a field day, haven't they? Okay, let's go back to our phones here. And, man, this is Toledo night, isn't it? Here's Robert in South Lyon. Robert, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the whole Wedding Crashers scenario.
Which is?
The scene where they're hunting in the woods, and he thinks that the two brothers are trying to get with his fiance.
Yeah, huh?
Shoots him in the ass. Kind of similar.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I didn't see that, but that's funny. How can this guy keep on keeping on? And one of the things he did, he went back to Wyoming, and he gave the University of, you know, he's an extraordinarily wealthy man. I mean, he's like in the top 1% of the population in terms of income. So he gave, I think it was $1.7 million, wrote him a check, and I guess, and those people gave him a big hand. So I guess they liked them, huh?
Here's... Yeah, also, I want also to bring up that when you're in your hunter safety class, all they stress more than anything else is never to drink while hunting.
Yeah.
And I guess he's disregarded that also.
Well, he says it was 4 hours, but again, we have no idea.
Still, I mean, if you say you have a few drinks and then you wait 4 hours and you go driving, you're in trouble.
Are you?
What makes it say it's okay to go hunting?
Well, at first they said, as someone brought up earlier, that all they'd had for lunch was Dr. Pepper, and then he, I think, admitted that they had had one beer. So, but given the fact that they waited so long, and in other words, say he would have had four beers. He was a little plastered, and his judgment was impaired. Well, if immediately they would have called the press and the police in, they would have said, whoa, this guy smells pretty bad. Maybe there's a violation here. But now we have nothing to go on except pure speculation, and that's what's left. That's what's left. So like when Cheney had these secret energy meetings with his pals from Enron, he was saying, well, we had the best interests of the United States at heart. Well, how do we know? I mean, they're closed proceedings. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Maybe I'll go check out the Wedding Crasher. Got to love it. All right, from the Toledo Mafia. Hey, Dennis, hi, you're on the air.
Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
I just wanted to chime in on this Cheney. It's kind of symbolic. Here he is, the trigger-happy chicken hawk, ready to shoot his buddy or anything that moves, and with no proof there's anything to shoot at. As well as the whole weapons of mass destruction fiasco. I just wanted to mention the first time that I ever really put a name to Dick Cheney's name to some action was back when he was, I don't know exactly what office he held at the time, but it was the morning that we lost 200 Marines in Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
That barracks was bombed.
Right.
He was on National Public Radio that morning, that same day, whatever, within hours of it happening, and I was listening to it on the radio driving my car, and something happened. One of the reporters out on this press conference either stumbled, slipped, dropped something. Anyway, something happened in the crowd, and I don't know how it was possible, but Cheney found some humor in that and actually chuckled.
Huh.
Now, how somebody could find something to laugh about, you know, within hours of losing 200 Marines, I just almost kind of pull my car over and say, you know, what kind of person is this?
Well, Cheney's also the kind of guy that could go over and shake Saddam Hussein's hand in the 1980s and present him with a pair of golden spurs. All right, Dennis, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us. Let's see. Our next caller is over to Canada. And Jared, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Thanks for making our show international.
Peter, I just want to say thanks for putting me on.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about the comic strip that was put out in Denmark.
Yeah, the cartoons of Mohammed, yeah.
Yep. I think it's about time that everyone learned a little humility. For the longest time, Jesus and God has been depicted in comics and been played jokes on, and I think it's about time that they learned some humility and just had a little laugh themselves.
Well, easily said, Jared, but it doesn't look like it's anybody's going to be listening to anything that you or I say about the situation. But how about what I said earlier, that there's a lot more at issue than just this the surface appearance of blasphemy, but rather a whole range of issues that that the Muslim people are angry at the West about, and particularly the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, I bet you if there wasn't the Iraq War, if there wasn't the United States' support of so many dictatorships with our tax monies here from the States, if the United States didn't support Israel, and this would have occurred, a few people would have been a little PO'd. But the fact that there's this whole range of abuses as they see it, they're reacting in a, I mean, not in an appropriate, in absolutely in an inappropriate way. I mean, there's a difference between making an excuse for something and giving an explanation. I can understand why this occurs, that it has no justification whatsoever.
Yeah, because I was reading in the Toronto Sun yesterday that there's a guy who put out a $1 million reward for the artist's head.
Yeah, let's make things even worse.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Just when I think look at these things were printed, last September or something, and this is going to calm down, all of a sudden, more riots. People killed. Amazing. All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in from Sarnia. Here's Brian in Redford. By the way, at about 8 or 9 minutes, I'll play the Dick Cheney song again. Cheney's got a gun. All right, here is Brian in Redford. Brian, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I was just calling to bring up the point about where our economy is going right now.
Yeah?
I'm 19 years old, and my dad is moving out of our house to go live in South Lyon. Essentially, I'm, you know, kind of getting kicked out.
Uh-huh.
Time for me to move on with my life. Well, at this point, it's really hard to find jobs, you know, and I'm 19 years old. How am I going to go out and find a job like you could 10 years ago?
Yeah, and particularly one that will pay enough for you to have an independent life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I'm supposed to start forward and keep going and get a good job and whatever, but I, you know, the economy is so bad. They're talking about laying off more people in Michigan from all these auto companies, and they're essentially going down because of the way the rest of the economy in the nation is going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really hard for me right now. I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
Well, I don't have any sage advice for you, that's for sure. I mean, because I think you are not in a good spot. I mean, it's not an expanding economy for people entering the job market. It's not things aren't what they were in other eras. In your dad's era, for instance, when he was 19.
And I'm a real liberal person. I usually, you know, don't mind about what's happening around me unless it's affecting me. And this, whatever Bush is doing over in Iraq is really hurting our nation. I think he really needs to stop that. I mean, it doesn't seem like anything's going on.
No. Well, don't think, by the way, I don't think you would, but don't think it's an option joining the service, or you might wind up in one of his adventures. Who knows where he's going to try to go next?
Yeah.
Because look, the vice president has an approval rating of 29%. I mean, that's absolutely disastrous. The president has an approval rating of about 40% on a good day, if he's lucky, and less when something else happens. So they're looking at midterm elections for Congress this November, and they are not going to allow this state of affairs with this low popularity to continue. So what are they going to do? What are they going to do? What crisis are they going to manufacture? That's truly frightening as well. All right. Did I cut him off? I did. I'm sorry. All right. Let's continue on to Joe in Augusta Township. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. How you doing, buddy?
Doing good. Thanks.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's see. Quickly, a correction for you. You had said earlier that that Osama had tweaked Bush's nose, you know, that you'll never catch me alive. That was actually Al-Zawahiri, the second in command of Al-Qaeda.
They now, just today, there's a new tape out.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I missed something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. God, there was something I had to say about Cheney, but how does that separate me from any other caller at this point? My main reason for my call is, have you seen anything about the, or are you familiar with Chandler's wobble, the wobble of the earth, like when you spin a top, it kind of wobbles?
Vaguely, yeah.
And it has to do with the gravitational pull of the sun and the moon. And basically, it goes in a seven-year cycle where if you visualize it as a wave, it's real wide, and then it narrows, and then over a seven-year period, it widens again and narrows and just goes on like that normally in seven-year periods. But I'm hearing since November, it's kind of flatlined, which is something that we haven't seen, you know, for quite some time.
Wait, I'm running out of time. So what's the implications of this?
Well, the implications of it are that the North Pole, the true North Pole, is moving, and that it kind of explains the tsunami. It could maybe even possibly explain the activity, you know, in the Atlantic that's creating all these hurricanes and everything. That true North is actually shifting. It also explains the so-called global warming, which is kind of a selfish theory because we all think of global warming as how it feels to us, but we're actually talking about the planet itself.
Yeah. Well, it's something to consider. I thank you for that. Maybe we can talk about it another time. Let's see here. Did we get this straight? Thanks to David writing into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. July 11th, 1804, at dawn, the duel began. The vice president, Aaron Burr, shot Alexander Hamilton. So the vice president, so there is a precedent for there, but this was a duel. So Vice President Burr shot Alexander Hamilton to death. Okay. So I hope we got that all settled. Here's David in Detroit. David, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Boy, you just read my email.
Oh, that was yours. Okay.
That was me, yeah.
Were we saying it? Were we saying it the reverse earlier?
I think originally you said it was Hamilton who shot Burr.
And yeah, I couldn't remember. Yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Hamilton actually fired his shot into the air,
uh-huh.
A gentlemanly thing to do. But the other thing I wanted to call about, I think you said that it was Cheney who brought the Golden Spurs over there to Saddam Hussein.
No, it was Rumsfeld.
Yeah, that was Donald, or Ronald Dumsfeld, as I like to call him.
Yeah, you're right. You know, by the way, unlike these right wingers, I demand correction. The last thing in the world I want to do is put out any more wrong information that's out there already. Yeah, I have a maybe somewhere on my website, I even have a photograph of Rumsfeld and Saddam Hussein shaking hands.
Well, and that's one of the things we appreciate about you. I'm a longtime listener, very infrequent caller, but I love the show. I just wanted to also talk about the cartoons of Muhammad just a little bit.
Sure.
I don't know if you know this part, but after the cartoons were printed, of course, a few months went by before all the brouhaha started.
Right.
And the cartoons were actually taken on a tour in the Middle East, along with three cartoons that weren't printed in the paper. There were some that were even more inflammatory than the ones that were printed.
Uh-huh.
And this has been blowing up, of course, over there at the same time that just a few months ago during the Hajj, all these pilgrims died due to, I guess the Saudis were not really taking care of the security precautions and the organization as well as they should have. And they've been really playing this up in their country, and I think, in a way, it's a little bit like something that the Bush administration does, which is play up something else to get their own scandal out of the news.
Well, I think it serves a lot of functions, and certainly that's one of them. On the other hand, dictators, unless they can completely control the way, as they put it, the masses function, it's always a little disturbing to them because they're always worried that they can get out of hand. David, I got to get another quick call, and here's Bruce from Dearborn Heights. Hey, Bruce, you're on the air.
Hey, How's it going, Pete?
Going great.
Yeah, you know me from New Age Citizen, and we had talked through email over the week over this cartoon controversy, and you know, to me, and I've done a lot of research on this over the past couple weeks, and the thing that's most troubling to me is that, you know, not to just look at it in terms of the Mideastern community, but just look at it in terms of the whole concept of blasphemy, which, of course, you know, the Supreme Court ruled against, I think, in 52. But I think the thing that is disturbing to me is that, you know, whether it's the Roman Catholic Church, who have done the Inquisitions.
Bruce, you have literally 60 seconds.
Okay, well, the thing that bothers me most is I think that if we kowtow to these Muslims that are so upset over this while we still allow things like Jesus to be displayed in a vat of urine and we allow the flag to be burned, if we make an exception to them, that I think we're going to find ourselves pushed back to kind of a pre-enlightened period. And I don't think we want to do that. And I guess my main comment is that I'm kind of upset of the timidity of the media in relationship to this whole thing.
I'm thinking if I had like the Detroit News or the Detroit Free Press, like some papers in the United States have printed the images, and there hasn't been hell to pay. There was like a paper in Philadelphia, and there was a demonstration there, which is fine. It works both ways, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly. But on the other hand, there is concern. I don't know. As I wrote in my email to you, I have kind of mixed feelings on it. We're going to have to carry this conversation on another time because I got to go. And I wanted to play one more time, Cheney's Got a Gun. Stay tuned for the interviews after these.
Dick Cheney's got a gun. Dick Cheney's got a gun. The safety's come undone. Squinting in the Texas sun. What did our leader do? Who did put a bullet through? They say when Cheney goes to Texas, you'll find him hunting.
Takes to be the next Riff Rock Girl, 101 WRIF and the Tri-County Pontiac GMC dealers, along with MGM Grand Detroit Casino, are looking for one very special woman to be the 2006 Riff Rock Girl. Think you can handle a $30,000 year-long contract? How about your choice of a new Pontiac or GMC? A Riff ad inside Stuff magazine? Oh yeah. And you'll be a star in a Riff TV commercial. Go ahead and mark it in your day planner now. The first casting call to find the Riff Rock Girl will be at March March 4th between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at GameWorks inside Great Lakes Crossing in Auburn Hills. If you're 21 or older, bring your bio and a photo of yourself to one of the RIS 3 auditions. For more details and official rules, visit WRIF.com. Are you the next Riff Rock Girl? The 2006 Riff Rock Girl Search. Presented by Tri-County Pontiac GMC Dealers. Also brought to you in part by MGM Grand Detroit Casino, where the city shines. And 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you, as usual. You know, I said last week I was only going to interview friends. and we're keeping up this pattern here. And in fact, a very old friend of mine who I go way back in...
Way back
in the entertainment world, radio, newspapers. He's Frank Joyce, a native Detroiter. Actually, Royal Oak, to be very precise. And he's been the news director of WABX and WDET here in Detroit. He was the news editor of the underground newspaper, the Fifth Estate. Most recently, and retired from that, the public relations director of the United Auto Workers, and some of you may remember when I worked on the IE America radio network, Frank Joyce was responsible for that, for better or for worse, but that's a story that we will not approach. Frank Joyce, when he worked with the Fifth Estate newspaper, took a trip to Vietnam in 1970. And 36 years later, he took another trip and to the same country. Frank Joyce, thanks for joining me. A pleasure to have you here. A pleasure to see you in person here in the studios.
Thanks, Peter. Nice to be here.
Well, one of the things, we have a deal. If he starts coughing uncontrollably, I keep talking, and the same thing with me. We both have the Michigan cold, I guess.
The Februaries. I think we have the Februaries.
I don't know the best way to really get at this. Maybe we could talk first about this current trip. That's a pretty exotic undertaking, going to Vietnam. Or is it? It's certainly a lot easier than it was 36 years ago.
Well, it's certainly a lot easier than it was 36 years ago. And it's more common than you might think. As I sort of think about the trip, and which was really quite incredible and intense and exciting, inspiring in many, many ways, I do make a kind of a division. There was the tourism part of the trip and the politics part of the trip. So let's just talk about the tourism for a minute. It's not that hard a country to get to these days. It's surprising how many Americans are going there, basically as tourists, of which the single largest group are veterans, are soldiers who fought in the war in Vietnam. I guess soldiers always want to go back. you know, soldiers go back to Germany and soldiers go back to Japan, and that is happening in Vietnam. And so most of the people that we met just in the course of wandering around the country who had met Americans before had met veterans. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, was a veteran peacenik, but that's not quite the same thing as as having been a soldier there. But more importantly than that, it's a very friendly country. It's a country that has accommodations at this point at all levels. You can live in luxury in Vietnam if you so choose, or you can be more modest, or just as we were leaving, a friend who was a part of our group had somebody who was coming the next week who planned to backpack completely through Vietnam and never stay in a hotel or have any of those traditional tourist amenities. And just a word about the food. We might want to talk a lot about the food.
I know you do.
The food I remember from my first trip, and I remember now, was great. It's a very interesting food culture because, of course, it has its own traditions and it has the influence of China and it has the influence of France. So there is, but it's a food conscious culture like France. People think about food, and they pay attention to it and they value it as part of the culture. And so, we ate very well, and anybody who goes to Vietnam will eat well. And just one footnote on that. That is in and of itself becoming destination travel. I believe it was the December issue of Bon Appetit had an article on the street food of Ho Chi Minh City, formerly Saigon, and the New York Times just 2 weeks ago had a story about restaurants in Hanoi.
Yeah. Frank Joyce is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He recently visited Vietnam and also did so in 1970, and we're going to get a comparison of those. United States in its war on Vietnam took the lives of about 3.5 million civilians in that country, virtually destroyed it. And I was, I saw a documentary recently that talked about still the birth defects that are happening from the use of Agent Orange, to defoliate the countryside. And yet, people come back. I've talked to travelers there and they say that there's no hostility. There's not a, is that what you found?
I did find that. The effects of the war linger. You're exactly right about that. While we were there, for example, there were two reports in the newspapers about young children who had been killed by landmines that they inadvertently stepped on. And Agent Orange continues to impact the country in many, many ways. And there's a lot of awareness about Agent Orange and its effects in Vietnam. What there is not is a lot of hostility toward Americans or, in an interesting way, I think, toward anyone. And that's part of what makes Vietnam such a fascinating and welcoming place. And let me say a couple things about why I think that's true and tell a story.
Sure.
This didn't happen to me. It happened again to someone who was a part of this group we were with, but they got into a conversation with somebody who, as I mentioned before, they were the first American that they had ever talked to who had not been a soldier, and who was not returning to Vietnam for that reason. And somehow the question came up of, well, isn't there a lot of antagonism towards Americans in Vietnam? And this person who was quite young, not alive when the war was going on, said, no, no, not at all. It was a she. It happened to be a woman. She said, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. She said, but we were occupied by the Chinese for 900 years. We were occupied by the Japanese off and on for 100 years. We were occupied by the French for 50 years. You guys were only here for 13 years. It's not that big a deal.
Wow.
Now, there's more to it than that, and that's a cute story. But I also think from the experience of both of these trips, I'm not sure why, but there's some chemistry between the Vietnamese people and Americans. You know, Ho Chi Minh, when he issued the Declaration of Independence for Vietnam in 1945, borrowed liberally from the United States Declaration of Independence. Ho Chi Minh worked in the United States for a time, and there just is, even soldiers that I know, family members who were officers and who did tours of duty in Vietnam, then and now, never failed to speak with admiration of the Vietnamese people. They were high quality enemies, among other things, when they were the enemy.
Frank Joyce, let's maybe we can interweave your previous trip, to Vietnam, which was in 1970, and you said it was significantly more difficult to get there. Now there's diplomatic relations between the United States and Vietnam. Then, the government of North Vietnam was officially fighting as an enemy. And, people, as we know from the Jane Fonda episode, people that went there were thought traitorous. So maybe you could speak to how you happened to go to Vietnam in 1970, how you conceive of your visit then, and how you reflect on it looking back.
Sure. I went as an anti-war activist. I had been active in the anti-war movement very early on in the anti-war movement, and was part of a group of four individuals from different representing kind of different constituencies of involvement in the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the peace movement itself, a woman who had been a civil rights activist and still is a civil rights activist in the Latino community. We were one of the first groups to take this kind of trip. The first group, you may or may not recall, and it was very shocking at the time, but Tom Hayden and Staunton Lind and Herbert Aptheker made the first peace movement visit to Hanoi. I believe it was in 1966. And I would say on average of one or two groups a year went until that time. And, of course, the most famous trip was that made by Jane Fonda, but that didn't happen until, I believe, 1972. Hmm. So it was logistically not particularly an easy place to get to. And politically, the war was ongoing. I remember being there and seeing from a distance B-52s in the sky, and there were air raids, and there were, it was one of the big differences between that trip and this was it was pretty much a fully militarized country. You saw soldiers everywhere. You saw military convoys everywhere. You saw anti-aircraft batteries in many places because the country was being bombed and it was under attack. That's, of course, couldn't be farther from the really very peaceful circumstances of today.
What was your route there in 1970?
By way of Vientiane, Laos, where we arrived on the day we arrived and were supposed to immediately then, and I have been trying to remember, I believe it was, I don't remember what airline was going at that point. Anyway, for various reasons we were detained. We wound up spending, I believe it was a week in Laos before we were able to get transportation from Vientiane into Hanoi, which turned out to be interesting in its own right. That was at a time when the United States was denying that it was militarily involved in Laos, which was not true. Laos was being bombed at that time. The military rationale for that was that the Vietnamese were using the Ho Chi Minh Trail, part of which came through Laos to move military supplies to the south, and therefore the United States was justified in attempting to interdict that traffic. But Laos and Vietnam today are very close allies. They both define themselves as socialist countries. It's still an interesting... it was an interesting relationship then. Vientiane was, it was like Marrakesh or whatever. It was like the CIA outpost A lot of interesting characters were in Laos at that point.
Well, I can't remember at the time, but certainly now, and mostly revolving around the Jane Fonda phenomena, that people that went there were considered to be aiding and abetting the enemy, that the actions were traitorous. How did you look at it then, and do you look at it any differently now?
I don't really look at it any differently now. I didn't look at it as traitorous then. I looked at it as an exercise of my right as a citizen to disagree with my own government and to oppose a policy that I profoundly disagreed with, a war that I thought was racist and wrong from the very beginning. I think that events vindicated that,
sure,
as a matter of fact. So there is a detail of this that people wonder about, and I think it's an interesting detail. The groups such as the one that I was with that went to Vietnam had a kind of a passport. People wonder, well, why in the world didn't you get arrested, you know, the minute you got off the plane on the way back? The reason for that was this. Delegations of the kind I was involved with were delivered mail to prisoners of war who were being held in North Vietnam by the military. So, and I don't mean this to sound cute, although it's kind of funny, but for all I know, I was John McCain's mailman. And there was no other way, because there were no other channels available at that point, or at least they weren't. This was the channel of communication between the families of POWs and the POWs themselves. And that really restrained the ability of the U.S. government to interfere with these trips.
Did you ever see any of the POWs?
No.
Yeah. When you were there, you said there was a lot of militarization. Did you see destruction? I mean, was there evidence of bombing, or did you see any fighting at any time? Were you at risk from, if you saw B-52s in the sky, you probably was a chance, but was it a scene like we've seen so frequently in films of Vietnam?
No. We were not in combat zones per se, that kind of ground war, if you will, was in the southern part of the country, not in the north. The north was only subjected to bombing raids by U.S. bombers, and in Hanoi itself, they claimed that they made surgical strikes, and to a surprising degree, they did. They did not engage in massive bombing of Hanoi just for purposes of trying to destroy the city. We crossed a bridge on this last trip that I had crossed when I was there before that was destroyed 14 times and rebuilt 14 times by the Vietnamese. In part of what's so significant, I think, about the dynamic of the war, of the inability of the United States to grasp either the tenacity or the commitment or the industrialness or the resourcefulness of the Vietnamese. And if you'll bear with me, I have a kind of a point about,
sure,
that bears on Iraq that was an interesting moment on this last trip. Because on my previous trip, I had been mostly in the area of Hanoi itself, and travel was still somewhat difficult inside of Vietnam, and of course it was extremely difficult then. So we didn't get that far, and I saw parts of the country on this trip that I had not seen on the previous one, including traveling through some of the canals of the Mekong Delta and so on and so forth, which is proved to be extremely difficult circumstances for the U.S. troops who were there. And I remember thinking, as I was kind of digesting the people we had talked to and looking at the terrain that was there and getting a sense of the difficulties of moving around the country, especially if you're coming from thousands and thousands of miles away, I remember thinking much more now than I did 36 years ago, what were they thinking? What gave them the idea that they could succeed where the French, the Japanese, and the Chinese had failed.
There is an analogy here to Iraq, isn't it?
Yes, that they could come over here and boss these people around. Yeah. What made them think that?
My guest is Frank Joyce on the Peter Werbe Show. Frank is formerly the news director of WABX and WDET here in Detroit, and also formerly the public relations director of the United Auto Workers. Let's go back to your 2006 trip. You said that it was partly tourism, although it's funny. When you go to, as you know, I was in Caracas just recently, and
yes.
And no matter which way you look at it, I mean, the political and the tourism intersect, to be sure.
That they do.
And it was the same thing there. But you are also, you said you had a very specific political purpose this time in Vietnam. There was a conference you attended, I understand.
There was a conference held in Hanoi that was co-hosted by the Ho Chi Minh Political Academy. And a group of American academics and scholars, some Marxists, some not, most, as I say, academics and most from the United States, but also from Ireland, Canada, and Turkey. And the overall subject of the conference was to talk about globalization, which is an interesting topic, sure. From the perspective of being in the labor movement in the United States, and also because just a few months previous, I had attended the Congress of the International Metalworkers Federation in Vienna, Austria, and their theme was globalization as well. So I had kind of this triangulation of the Vietnamese perspective, the U.S. perspective, and that of an international organization of trade unionists from all over as kind of how do we look at this phenomenon of globalization. And it's true, and I'm sure you had the same experience in Venezuela. There is a genie that's out of the bottle here, and there isn't anybody who isn't trying to think about what the hell do we do with this thing?
I would think that, this is just off the top of my head, that Vietnam might be a little more sympathetic to globalization, for instance, than some of the other countries.
Vietnam is very sympathetic to globalization in this regard. For one thing, they're very clear. And this is a distinction, I think, with many of my brothers and sisters in the trade union movement here. They say the starting point of this is it's inevitable, it's happening, and we have to figure out how to adjust to it, as opposed to spend a lot of time trying to figure out maybe how could we make it go backwards, or how could we make water run uphill here. Globalization is here to stay. That's the starting point that the Vietnamese use to look at this. And so they say it's not whether we're going to have it or not. The question is, how are we going to deal with it? As happened earlier in China, the Vietnamese made a decision, in their case in 1986, that they were going to abandon kind of any pretense of economic isolationism, and they adopted a policy called Moi Doi, which essentially is economic liberalization and the invitation to foreign capital to invest in Vietnam. And we'll talk some more about this in a minute. The first point to make here...
Probably at lunch, because we have about 3 minutes left.
All right. Well, the first point to make here is this. Vietnam is the world's second fastest growing economy.
Really?
China is the world's first fastest growing economy. And there's something I think worth thinking about for us in this country about this interesting combination of capitalism and socialism in terms of its ability to address problems like poverty and the building of housing and healthcare issues and so on and so on. I do think there's something going on that we don't think about and that we don't pay much attention to, and we say, well, there isn't any socialism anymore and the Soviet Union collapsed and these countries are permitting capitalists to operate there, so end of story. I think it's the beginning of the story, not the end at all.
Well, maybe it's what Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, speaks about 21st century socialism. In one hand, he invites foreign investment at a better rate of return for the country and uses it to alleviate the grinding poverty that the people there experience. It sounds very similar.
Yes, I would say that there are a couple of, and I learned more about this, but Malaysia, for example, very aggressively is a capitalist country and is committed to eradicating poverty. But the number of nations that have as a high, let alone number one national priority, the elimination of poverty, is very few.
Yeah, certainly not ours.
It's certainly not the United States.
Yeah. So a lot of these old definitions of socialism, communism, capitalism, maybe it is the synthesis of it, that whereas Marx wanted to eliminate the property forms per se, whether nationally owned or privately held, that maybe, and resurrect, restore human community, I'm thinking that maybe in the economic field, it still remains selling labor, investments, industrial development, and what we should be looking for particularly is restoring human community in our private lives. Well, that's a whole... Why did I say that about...
And we have how much time left?
Well, yeah, and well, we do almost have to sum up, Frank Joyce. Is it possible to, in a minute or so, to sum up the differences and the similarities between your two trips?
I don't think it is in a minute or so. I think it's... I'd rather spend a minute or so on these two subjects. One, if you get a chance to go to Vietnam, go. It's just... go in any way you want. Just go as a tourist or whatever. It's a beautiful country. It's a friendly country. It's an exciting country. You can, I described it at the time as, you know, it's like seeing, like being in med school. You can sort of see the kidneys and the liver and the stomach of the economy all out in plain view. You see these incredible, a water buffalo will be next to a huge construction site. I mean, you can see an economy in the morning, so to speak, and sense the excitement that comes with that on the part of a population, 80% of whom are 25 years old or younger.
Wow.
There's just something being created there that is fascinating and illuminating to behold.
Thank you, Frank Joyce, for being with me and for telling us about your two trips to Vietnam. Any, and this is, I don't know if you have this off the top of your head, anything online that we could go to, I don't know, try, just put Vietnam in your search engine.
Put Vietnam in your search engine. The government, just while we were there, launched a website.
There you go.
And I don't know the URL off the top of my head, but and it does have an English language division, if you will.
Frank, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
This is WRIF.com. Now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. You're listening to WRIF.com. Yeah.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you as usual. A wonderful book has come my way. It was in hardcover a few years ago, now in paper. I Can't Find My Way Back Home. It's America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. And the author is Martin Torgoff. He's been a contributing editor of Interview and a producer for CNN's World Beat. He's a documentary filmmaker, the author of several books, including the best-selling Elvis, We Love You Tender, and American Fool, The Roots and Improbable Rise of John Cougar Mellencamp. And we're talking to him in his home in New York City. Martin Torgoff, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Or were we such a product of the Great Stoned Age we can't remember, neither of us, whether or not I interviewed you when this came out in hardcover?
Well, I like to think that I've regenerated a lot of my brain cells over the last 15 years.
Well.
We are a product of that, and that's why I wrote the book. It was an attempt to understand how our culture has been shaped over the last half century by the use of illicit drugs, and it really has been.
Mm-hmm. You know, I rarely like to rely on press releases, but the one accompanying your book, Can't Find My Way Home, from Simon & Schuster, says illicit drugs, as you were indicating, have transfigured the American cultural landscape in the past half century, leaving their mark on everything from art, music, literature, sexuality, spirituality, pop culture, the economy, and politics, to crime, public health, and national law enforcement policy. And there's no way in the world I ever could have assembled that list in my brain without the help from this. That's why I read from it. But this is absolutely astounding. There was supposed to be a war on drugs, while J. Edgar Hoover and Harry Anslinger and Richard Nixon and the rest of them might as well just come with their hands up. I mean, they've lost, eh?
Well, I mean, if you just look at the more recent version of it, Ronald Reagan began a great national crusade against illicit drugs when he took office in 1980. He rolled into office thinking that he had a mandate to roll back drug use in the United States, exactly like he wanted to roll back Soviet expansionism and the size of the federal government. And in 1982, he ran up his battle flag. And since then, we've spent something like $500 billion trying to make this a drug-free America. Now, is it any more of a drug-free America in 2005 than it was in 1982 or 1989 when Bush came in? Or it's an ongoing saga. It's now become a multi-generational experience in this country.
Yeah, part of it, of course, legal. Millions of people having been dragged through the legal system for wanting to change their consciousness. I was just having lunch with someone today, and I said, I guess we took our choice, either a war on drugs or something like a national health program for all of us.
Well, we've certainly made that choice. And now it's really interesting because, there's a real drug reform policy movement in the United States now. I mean, whether you look at it as, some of the medical marijuana initiatives or, sentencing reform, is where people have gotten together and said, here's an area where the war on drugs has just gone too far. And, little by little, incrementally, I think there's more of a sensibility that not only is it not working, but it's not working in ways that have been harmful to this country as well. Whether you're looking at civil liberties or a policy like no clean needle exchange in segments of the society, where there's the greatest spread of HIV infection as a result of intravenous needle use. There are many, many areas now where over time the evidence is there. So there's a real drug policy reform movement in this country now, whereas, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't that there. It wasn't that. But even so, any kind of change is going to be so incremental, so slow.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons, of course, that it's so slow, there's certainly not a politician. There's very few people anywhere that will make a public utterance in this that would declare drugs to not be harmful, dreadful, crime-inducing, mental and physical destructive element. And so maybe, and tell me if this, if we find this in your book, Can't Find My Way Home, where's the positive? All of this is so awful.
Yeah.
Why has it persisted as a national phenomena for so long?
Well, I mean, I think the answer to that question is complicated, and it, you know, the answer is on many levels. It has to do with who we are as Americans, and it has to do with basic human nature. You know, these substances have been around since the beginning of time. You know, plant, psychoactive plants, whether it's cannabis or coca leaf or the opium plant, the grape, you know, ever since man has crushed grapes. This is an old story. It's here, and it's not going anywhere. I mean, of course, what you have here, and this is the story I try to tell in my book, is the uniquely modern American cultural version of it, which is, you know, the greatest consumer society on the face of the earth, you know, the most technologically and industrial advanced society, adopting the use of these on a mass level. You know, that has never really happened before in history. You know, the real core of my book takes place in the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, I begin at the Second World War.
Well, actually,
bebop and the Beat Generation. But it's, you know, in the 60s and in the 70s, that's when it really happens. And that's when we go from a nation in which there are like maybe 500,000 people smoking marijuana to something like 20 to 30 million people smoking marijuana.
Well, one of the, I'm sorry I started to interrupt you, Martin Targoff. And the reason that I did was exactly to ask you that, and you kind of answered it. You talk in your book, Can't Find My Way Home, of course, the title taken from the Blind Faith tune of the same name. But in the subtitle, America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945, people, a lot of people listening probably say, wow, did anybody do drugs before 1966 or something like that?
Yeah.
And you quickly went over it, you know, bebop and beats. Talk about why you began in 1945. Certainly, you go back into the 1930s, and there's what the old Cab Calloway song.
And the reefer culture of the 30s,
sure.
And
but,
you know, well, look, I mean, just briefly encapsulating it, you know, in 1914 with the Harrison Narcotic Act, we declared narcotics to be illegal in this country, and from that moment on, there was a drug underground. It wasn't a large one, but it existed. And in the 30s, you know, marijuana found its way into the United States over the border with the Mexican laborers and, you know, into New Orleans and then up the river with the jazz musicians to Chicago. You can almost follow it along with Louis Armstrong in the early 20s, and then it made its way over to New York and took root in the, you know, the great Harlem reefer culture of the 30s that, you know, coalesced around swing music. And that was also the time of the first national drug crusade, Harry Anslinger, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, which declared marijuana illegal.
And we think of swing as being so square.
That's right, we do. And in point of fact, those musicians were high as kites. Lester Young, I mean, one after another, Billie Holiday.
Betty Goodman, yeah.
And so, you know, the musical culture has always had a relationship with, you know, mind-expanding substances. But, you know, what happened in this country was totally unique with it. And, you know, so then you had these musicians, this underground society of vipers. So by the end of the Second World War, when the war is over and everyone's coming back to build the great American century, you have a number of things happen. You have these two movements in the United States. Bebop, who of course were, you know, the musicians like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and John Coltrane. It was a sensibility, and some of the great genius artists of that time became junkies. They really didn't know what they were getting involved with. At the same time, the then mafia was just beginning to organize the global trade in heroin, and of course, their marketplace that they picked was Harlem. So you have really what began the first drug epidemic in modern American history in Harlem. Claude Brown chronicles it in his wonderful classic book, Man-Child in the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the late 40s and through the 50s, that was going on with heroin. But then you have these writers, you know, this small group of writers, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs. And these guys were fascinated with drugs, and they evolved a whole body of literature that was written in the authentic language of people who use drugs as a way of life. And the characters use drugs in the book, and it was very much identified with a sort of like bohemian revolt. This was new. And the kids, the high school kids of the late 1950s who were attracted to this music and to this literature, they knew that, this it was the ultimate evil. I mean, there had been wild-eyed anti-drug films for almost 20 years by that point, films like Reefer Madness and Cocaine Fiends that we've seen. The society was telling everyone, that if you use drugs, you'd be going to become an axe murderer or a dope fiend. And yet, these middle-class high school kids gravitated towards it. They were fascinated by it and everything that it represented. And it represented many different things. I mean, it was not just, kicks. It was, there was something powerfully cultural. There was a sort of political aspect to it.
Well, I was going to say, then and even now, let's talk about the most benign of illegal substances, marijuana. You knew it was an act of rebellion in and of itself, forgetting about the impact it would have on your consciousness. And anyone who does it today, a middle-class lawyer or a high school kid or wherever, they know that they are breaking the law. They know that they're involved in a transgression, and that's part of the appeal.
Yeah, it is part of the appeal. And, I was a teenager growing up in the 1960s. I came of age in that period where there was the biggest surge of drug use statistically in the history of the country. And my father was a kid in the 1930s, and they grew up thinking that if, anyone smoked marijuana, they were going to become a heroin addict. And that's, of course, what he told me. And as soon as I, my experience indicated otherwise, I felt empowered to just, act out and do it more.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, at that time, there was the music. As interesting and revolutionary as bebop was as a form of jazz, it had nowhere near the impact of the music of the 1960s on a whole generation of people and their attraction, the allure to use drugs. I mean, I don't have to tell you the groups or the titles because you play them
sure.
on the radio station all the time.
Right.
I mean, these became like anthems. These were manifestos of drug use, whether it was, Grace Slick and White Rabbit or the Beatles, A Day in a Life, the music of Hendrix. It just goes on and on and on. It just something that had never really happened before. These were artists using drugs, specifically psychedelics and marijuana, making music under the influence of these drugs for people who are going to be under the influence of the same drugs in an age of mass media. That had never happened before.
The book is Can't Find My Way Home. Subtitle is America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, the author, Martin Torgoff. The book is available now in paper. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. So here we have this mass cultural phenomena that takes that brings, if we add it up, everyone who has smoked marijuana, which is probably vast, far and away the vast number of people who have.
It is three quarters.
Okay.
The,
But so we're talking about tens of millions of people.
Well, I'll tell you what the latest statistics are.
Sure.
I mean, I'm a little skeptical of the accuracy of government statistics on drugs to begin with, but I can cite them pretty fluently. And last year, the Department of Health and Human Services did a survey, over 90 million Americans admit to using an illicit substance at some point in their lifetime. Three quarters of that number are marijuana experiences. Well, that translates to roughly 40% of the population. Now, it used to be 70 million. I mean, that was the figure that most people sort of worked with. And, you know, that meant that almost one in four Americans had done it. And people would think, well, my God, that's a staggering statistic.
Mm-hmm.
But in point of fact, it's even more than that. It's now over 90 million.
Well, I will publicly admit to experiment. What do they always say? Experimenting with marijuana in college, right? That's what is fashionable today. You know, actually, during the Democratic primary last year, there was one panel in which people, all the candidates were asked whether or not they had ever used marijuana. And everyone other than, I can't think of his name, the Reverend from New York, Sharpton.
Al Sharpton.
Yeah, Al Sharpton. He said, I'm a minister. I never used it.
Yeah.
Everyone else just kind of said, yeah, and then it was not an issue. So
yeah.
On one hand, as you said earlier, that there are great efforts made towards drug policy reform. I mean, the war on drugs has just been this hideous waste of money, this tragic human toll that it's taken. And yet the arrests continue. The people's lives are ruined, not so much by the drugs as by the law. And that continues apace.
Yeah, it does. And it's not going to stop any time soon. I mean, especially now that, the sort of right wing is so entrenched in this country. The Republican Party has a base of something like, 60 million religious conservatives. And it's very hard to talk rationally about the war on drugs and drug policy reform with these people, because they tend to see these substances as tools of Satan, quite literally. I mean, you can't have a rational discussion about drugs with these people. And in general, conservatives tend to be with the drug war. It's such a an orthodoxy to them. It's so ideological, the fervor, the belief that they are evil and that the only way to deal with them is through prohibition and punitive policy and that kind of thing.
Don't they want the government off our back? Isn't it one of their little mantras? What happens
well,
in this case?
Well, that's the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. And even that is a little bit iffy about the drug war. Those are the Republicans that are critical of the war on drugs as the libertarians. The interesting thing is they are as kind of illogical about the drug war as, the Democrats, the liberals, used to be about welfare reform. I mean, most of the time they weren't interested in whether it was working or not. You know, it was so deeply entrenched in their political philosophy and their cultural ideology that, it was like a fundamentalist observer in a religious faith or something. And that's why any kind of change in drug policy is going to be painfully slow.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the marijuana initiatives. They pass over and over again, and yet the government steadfastly refuses to allow the will of the people.
Well, what's in this Puritan culture? I mean, on the cover of your book, Can't Find My Way Home, you quote from the New York Times book review, and it says, in part, an exuberant chronicle of ecstatic inebriation. And I'm a couple times talking on the air about the use of the drug ecstasy. I said, you take this drug, it makes you want to love everyone and dance all night. Call the cops, what is ingrained in this Puritanism that, and this may be, beyond, I don't have any real answers for it, beyond the scope of your book, but ecstatic inebriation, what's so bad about that? I mean, let me just frame it another way. One of the problems is there's no boundaries in this society. Other, like, societies that use intoxication and religious rites and what have you, pre-technological societies, they're used very specifically. Here, there's one of the problems, and I think that's what leads to abuse on a small by a small minority of people, is that there are no boundaries.
No, there are no boundaries, and I think we're hurt by that. We're hurt by a lot of things about our national drug policy. To me, one of the saddest things that I found, look, I worked on this book a long time. It took me over a decade to do it. It comes out of my own experience, using drugs, abusing drugs, having to give them up eventually, having to come to terms with my whole past about it, and my whole generation. It was an attempt to understand my whole generation's experience. But one of the things that I really found was, as we've now gotten older and had our own kids, I mean, you're looking like two or three generations down the line from my father, who told me, please don't smoke marijuana because you're going to become a heroin addict. And yet, what happens over and over again is that there's a kind of cultural amnesia about it. We are not allowed to be honest about it, and therefore, what gets lived and learned, what really gets accrued in the way of knowledge and wisdom about it, does not get passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only do we not learn, but we get kind of damned to make the same mistakes over and over again.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. I actually have two very important questions, I think, and kind of personal. So you answer them however you want, Martin Torgoff. After listening to what we've talked about, someone could say, well, your dad was right. I mean, you, as you just said, you were involved in drug abuse, so dad's old advice from the 1960s was correct.
No, he was wrong. He told me I was going to become a heroin addict, and I never did.
Okay.
And it's ironic, too, because I never even got close to being a heroin addict. I never stuck a needle in my arm.
I never saw any heroin in all the years of the 60s and 70s. I never even saw any. Go ahead.
No, but that doesn't mean that I did not damage myself on, you know, like a ton of cocaine and alcohol and all kinds of other things that were around. And it wasn't even so much the substances themselves that caused me any kind of damage. It was the sort of waste of time, the squandering of personal resources over the years. I mean, I was very lucky. I mean, there were people who just sort of crashed and burned spectacularly.
Sure.
And I was never in that category. But there's no doubt about the fact that I abused drugs, you know, willingly and consciously. And so did all of my friends, and to a large degree, so did my generation. Do I regret it? No, ultimately I don't, because I was able to learn something. I was able to take something away from it. And there were a lot of people who didn't. Look, addiction, which is like sort of the dark side of this, there are several dark secrets underneath this story.
Well,
one of them is addiction.
Yeah.
As anyone knows who's ever been an addict, addiction is a terrible thief. It robs you of money, it robs you of resources, it robs you of sometimes life itself. But the other really dirty secret is that the vast majority of people who did use drugs during that time did not become addicts. They did not become horrific drug abusers. Most of them tended to be moderate social users who, you know, were able to sort of control their use, to use it in some sort of like responsible recreational way. And then, you know, they outgrew it. They moved on with their lives. They were able to set boundaries, intelligent boundaries, and say, you know, yeah, I don't want to smoke pot. You know, if I'm some sort of attorney and I'm preparing a brief for the next day,
absolutely.
You know, I don't want to go home and like smoke this dube.
Let me interrupt you just a second here, because we got just maybe 30 seconds.
Okay.
And the big one is about lessons. We delayed this interview a little because your two-year-old had to be put off for a nap, and we literally have 30 seconds.
Okay.
What do you tell your two-year-old when he or she's a 16-year-old and he says, Dad, is it all right if I smoke marijuana?
well, I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna lay it all out for him. I'm gonna say, I want you to really understand what you're dealing with here, and I want you to look at it from all the angles. And ultimately, he's gonna do what he's gonna do. I mean, I would prefer that he not smoke pot if he's going to do it until he's much older.
Mm-hmm.
At least out of high school and into college. I think there can be some problems with adolescence and marijuana use. There's no doubt about it. However, having said that, if he persists in doing it, I will try to educate him to be as responsible and as circumspect and as self-responsible and intelligent about it as possible.
And I think we're going to have to leave it at that. My guest, Martin Torgoff, author of Can't Find My Way Home, now in paper, subtitle America in the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. Great history, great analysis. Check it out. It's Simon & Schuster. Martin Torgoff, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
You're at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy at the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Have a job for her.
And they all lived happily ever after.
Bring the looks and the personality, and we'll give you the 30 grand salary and the hot new wheels. The Riff Rock Girl Search is on.
I can't get enough.
Everything rocks. That rocks.
Today from my friends in my head,
found God.